All right, welcome to the deep dive. You know how this works. You send in the sources, and we get straight to the heart of them. We pull out all the good stuff. We give you the key knowledge and insights so you don't have to. Think of us like your personal guide through all this material curated just for you.
And today, that journey takes us right into the middle of Jerusalem, a city buzzing with activity, with a story that's about to get very interesting. We're going to look closely at some pivotal moments, some real turning points in the life of Jesus.
Absolutely. So the stuff you sent us, it's from a lecture, right? By Dr. Daniel K. Darko. All on the Gospel of Luke, specifically Luke chapter 20, verses 1 through 4 of chapter 21.
That's right.
And today's mission, well, it's pretty straightforward, I think. We're going to dive deep into these encounters between Jesus and the authorities, you know, the religious leaders of the time. We're going to see what kind of challenges they threw at him. And most importantly, we're going to unpack what these interactions tell us about Jesus, his authority, and how people reacted to him. And, you know, honestly, I think you'll be surprised by some of the things we uncover even in these well-known biblical stories.
I think so, too.
So to set the stage, remember, Jesus has just made this really dramatic, really triumphant entry into Jerusalem. But he doesn't just visit. He actually sets up a kind of base of operations in the temple itself, making it his teaching hall, as Dr. Darko puts it.
And that's a big deal. That's not something you just do.
Oh, no, not at all. It's a bold move.
Yeah.
You know, he's really challenging the existing order by taking on this very public role, teaching in the temple courts. And it's fascinating. You know, we see this stark contrast between the people and the authorities.
Yeah, I was just going to say that.
Like the general public. They seem pretty open to Jesus. They're listening and in some cases even praising him.
Mm-hmm.
But the authorities, the chief priests, the scribes, the elders, they're immediately suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
They're not buying it.
It's all right there in Luke chapter 20, verse 1. They just come straight out and say, tell us, by what authority are you doing these things? Who gave you this authority?
It's a power struggle, plain and simple.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And it's important to remember, these guys, the authority, they're the custodians of the temple. It's their turf.
Yeah.
So from their point of view, this guy just waltzing in, assuming the central role, it's a problem. Dr. Darko gives this really helpful analogy. Imagine, you know, someone just showing up at a church and taking over the pulpit.
Yeah, that's not going to go over well.
Right. The leadership would absolutely have the right to ask, who are you and what gives you the right to do this?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But Jesus, well, he doesn't give them a straight answer, does he?
No.
Instead, he throws it right back at them. He hits them with his counter question, all about the authority of John the Baptist.
Mm-hmm.
He says, I'll ask you a question. Now tell me, was the baptism of John from heaven or was it from men? Luke 20.3.
And this is classic rabbinic teaching technique. It's not about avoiding the issue. It's about making them think, making them really examine their own beliefs.
He's calling their bluff.
Exactly. And you can almost see the wheels turning as they discuss this amongst themselves, right? They realize if they say, okay, John's authority came from heaven, then Jesus is going to say, well, then why didn't you believe him? But if they say, no, it was just a human thing, then they risk the wrath of the people who, for the most part, really believed John was a prophet. They're stuck.
It's like a theological checkmate.
It really is. And what do they say? We don't know. That's their answer. They can't or won't take a stand on John, which tells you a lot about their priorities.
Fear of public opinion, not exactly a profiling courage, is it? And then, because of their non-answer, Jesus says, fine, then I won't tell you by what authority I do these things either. Luke 20.8.
Mic drop.
Seriously. And that whole exchange, it just underscores how incredibly savvy Jesus was, right?
Yeah.
He knew exactly what he was doing. He was a master of this kind of religious and political maneuvering. He completely silences them, at least for now.
Yeah, but this is only the beginning.
Oh, there's so much more to come.
Yeah.
Buckle up. So we move on to what's known as the parable of the vineyard. This is Luke 20, verses 9 through 18. And it's a story, it's an allegory that Jesus tells directly to the people. But as Dr. Darko points out, the religious leaders, they know. They know he's talking about them. In fact, Luke 20.19 tells us that the scribes and chief priests sought to lay hands on him at that very hour, for they perceived that he had told this parable against them.
So let's break down this parable. A man plants a vineyard, he leases it to tenants, and then at harvest time, he sends servants to collect his share of the fruit. It sounds reasonable, right? But the tenants, they mistreat the servants. They beat them, they drive them away, and they even kill some of them.
It's brutal.
It is. But the owner, he's persistent. He sends more servants, but they get the same treatment. Finally, he says, okay, I'll send my son, my beloved son. Surely they'll respect him.
But they don't, do they?
No. They see the son as a rival, the heir apparent, and they kill him too, thinking they can seize the inheritance for themselves.
It's a really dark story when you think about it.
It is. And Dr. Darko helps us to understand the symbolism here. The vineyard, he says, represents the house of Israel. The tenants are the religious leaders. And the owner, of course, represents God. God sends prophets time and again, but they're rejected, even killed. And finally, he sends his son, Jesus.
Foreshadowing much.
Yeah, heavy foreshadowing. And in the parable, the owner's reaction to all this is pretty straightforward. He destroys those tenants and he gives the vineyard to someone else. And, you know, it's interesting. The people listening, they react with shock. They say, surely not. Luke 20.16. Like, they can't believe such a harsh judgment would be necessary.
It's like they're hoping for a different ending.
Maybe. But Jesus doesn't let them off the hook. He looks at them and he quotes from Psalm 118.22.23. The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone.
This part, this cornerstone analogy, it's key. Like, it's the whole point.
Right. Dr. Darko really emphasizes that. Jesus, the one they're trying to discredit, to push aside, he's going to become the very foundation. And that has some pretty serious implications. As Jesus says, everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces. And when it falls on anyone, it will crush him. Luke 20.18.
Those are some pretty strong words.
They are. There's no escaping the significance of Jesus's role, no matter what they try to do. And Dr. Darko even brings up a parallel passage in the Gospel of Thomas, you know, one of those non-canonical gospels, which shows how widespread these themes were in early Christian thinking.
Fascinating. So the parable ends. The authorities, they're furious. Luke 20.19 tells us they want to arrest Jesus right then and there.
Can't say I blame them from their perspective.
But they're scared of the people. They know they can't just grab him without causing a riot. So what do? They change tactics again. They get sneaky.
They send in the spies.
Exactly. They recruit these guys to pretend they're genuinely interested in what Jesus has to say, all in the hopes of trapping him, getting him to say something that will get him in trouble with Rome.
And what better topic to try and trip him up on than taxes?
Oh, yeah. Taxes. Super sensitive issue in Roman-occupied Palestine. Nobody likes paying taxes to the emperor. So these spies, they come up to Jesus and they lay it on thick. Teacher, they say, we know you speak and teach what's right, and you don't show partiality. You truly teach the way of God. So tell us, is it lawful for us to give tribute to Caesar or not? Luke 20.21.22.
It's a setup.
Total setup. If Jesus says, yes, pay your taxes, he risks alienating the people. But if he says, no, don't pay taxes, he's basically advocating rebellion against Rome.
And that's not going to end well for him.
Not at all. But Jesus, well, let's just say he sees right through their little scheme. He knows exactly what they're up to.
And this is where he delivers one of his most famous lines.
Well, this is good. So he says to them, show me a denarius whose image and inscription are on it. They answer, Caesar's. And then comes the zinger. Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's. Luke 20.24.25.
It's brilliant. Dr. Darko, he points to this scholar named Fitzmyer, who outlines three ways to interpret this saying. One is this idea of two kingdoms. You know, you have your civic duty, your obligations to the state, and then you have your obligations to God.
Like separate spheres of influence.
Exactly. Another interpretation is that it's ironic, like Jesus is saying, sure, give Caesar his measly coins, but what really matters is what you give to God. And then there's the idea that this is a kind of anti-zealot statement. You know, the zealots were all about violent rebellion against Rome.
And Jesus was decidedly not.
Right. So this statement might be his way of distancing himself from that kind of extremism.
But there's another layer to this whole exchange that Dr. Darko picks up on that I find really interesting. The fact that Jesus asks to see the coin, the denarius.
Oh, I see what you're getting at.
Right. By asking to see it, he's subtly pointing out that the authorities themselves are using Roman currency, which at that time would have had the image of Tiberius Caesar on it.
And not just his image, but also inscriptions calling him son of the divine Augustus.
Exactly. So it's like Jesus is saying, hey, you're all using this money that literally proclaims Caesar as a divine figure. So maybe you're not in such a strong position to be questioning me about my authority.
Ouch, that's gonna sting.
Yeah, pretty clever, right? And the result? Well, Luke tells us that they couldn't trap him. They marveled at his answer and became silent. Luke 20.26. Jesus wins again.
He's on a roll, but they're not giving up.
Oh, no, not even close. So Next up, we have the Sadducees, and they come to Jesus with a question about, of all things, the resurrection.
Yeah, this is where it gets really interesting.
Before we get into their question, let's do a quick rundown on who the Sadducees were.
Right. So Dr. Darko explains that the Sadducees were basically this group of elite, powerful Jews. They were largely composed of priests and those connected to the temple. They were very much about maintaining the status quo. They didn't believe in the resurrection of the dead. That was a big difference between them and the Pharisees.
Like a fundamental difference.
Huge difference. The Sadducees, they mainly focused on the written Torah, the first five books of the Hebrew Bible. And they were actually pretty open to Hellenistic culture, which was, you know, the dominant Greek culture of the time.
A little more cosmopolitan than some of the other nips.
Exactly. And Dr. Darko suggests that their roots might go all the way back to Zadok, who was the high priest during King David's reign.
Interesting. So they approach Jesus with this scenario based on the Levirate marriage law. It's found in Deuteronomy 25.5-6.6. Basically, if a man dies without having children, his brother is supposed to marry the widow to provide an heir for the deceased brother.
And the Sadducees, they take this law and they create this really convoluted situation with seven brothers who all marry the same woman, one after the other.
Like a really twisted family tree.
Right. And their question is, in the resurrection, whose wife will she be? Luke 20.28-33.
It's a trick question designed to make the idea of the resurrection sound ridiculous.
Exactly. Dr. Darko even takes a moment to explain the logic behind levirate marriage. It wasn't just some random custom. It was all about ensuring the continuation of a family line, especially in ancient Near Eastern cultures.
It's like in those days, family inheritance, it was everything.
Absolutely vital. So the Sadducees, they're trying to use this very specific law to undermine the whole concept of resurrection. But Jesus, he doesn't take the bait.
He shuts them down pretty hard, actually.
Yeah, he basically says, look, marriage, that's for this life. It's about having children and continuing the human race. But in the resurrection, things are going to be different. People are going to be like angels, and there's no marriage in heaven. Luke 20.34-36.
And then he goes even further. Right?
He does. He quotes from their own holy book from Exodus 3.6, where God says, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Jesus points out, look, God doesn't say, I was the God of Abraham, or I was the God of Isaac. He says, I am their God. Luke 20.37-38.
Implying that they're still alive in some way.
Exactly. God is the God of the living, not the dead. And this comes straight from Moses, the one they revere above all others. So even their own scriptures, according to Jesus, support the idea of resurrection.
And the scribes, those who believed in the resurrection, they're loving this. They chime in with, Teacher, you have spoken well. Luke 20.39. It shows that even among the religious experts, there was disagreement about some pretty major theological points.
Yeah, no kidding. And just when you think it's over, Dr. Darko points out this other little exchange where Jesus flips the script and starts questioning them about the Messiah being David's son.
Right. This is based on Psalm 110.1, Luke 20.41-44. It's another example of Jesus challenging their assumptions, showing them that they don't have all the answers.
Always turning the tables.
Always. And then, as Luke 20 comes to a close, Jesus shifts his focus to his disciples, and he gives them this warning about the scribes.
Yeah, this is where things get a little more personal.
So, Dr. Darko lays out the characteristics Jesus calls out. These scribes, they love being recognized in public, they wear fancy robes, they want to be greeted with respect in the marketplaces, they like the best seats in the synagogues, at banquets. You know, front row seats for everything.
All about appearances.
Totally. Yeah. And they make a big show of their piety with these long, drawn-out prayers. But the worst part, the thing Jesus condemns most strongly, is the way they exploit widows.
Now, this is interesting. Dr. Darko dives into this, referencing Fitzmyer's work. And he gives like six different ways the scribes might have been taking advantage of widows.
Like really specific examples.
Yeah, like maybe they were charging them huge fees for legal services, or maybe they were just straight up stealing from them, or maybe they were taking advantage of their hospitality. You know, expecting widows to feed and house them when they were traveling around. Or maybe they were misusing funds that widows had donated for religious purposes.
Awful.
Yeah. Or, get this, maybe they were even taking their houses as payment for debts. It's not entirely clear which methods they were using, but the point is clear they were exploiting these vulnerable women.
And Jesus, he holds them up as a cautionary tale. He's basically saying, don't be like these guys. Don't be hypocrites.
Pretty strong message.
Yeah. So to sum up this whole whirlwind of a chapter, we see Jesus really establishing his role as a teacher right there in the heart of the temple. He engages in these pointed public debates, and he takes on these different groups, the chief priests, the scribes, the Sadducees, and he skillfully dismantles their arguments.
He's a master debater, and he knows his scriptures inside and out. He knows exactly how to use their own words against them.
And this is all happening in Jerusalem, the center of Jewish religious life. It's high-stakes stuff.
Extremely high-stakes.
And it's all building towards something bigger.
It is.
This is the lead-up to the Passion, to the events that will ultimately lead to Jesus' crucifixion. And we see him facing these challenges with incredible wisdom and courage.
It really shows the kind of pressure he was under and how he handled it.
And then, just as we're wrapping up Luke 20, we get this little transition into Luke 21, right? Jesus has just been talking about these scribes exploiting widows. And then the very next chapter opens with this story about a widow who gives this small but very meaningful offering.
It's a powerful contrast.
It is. So what we see in Luke 20 is Jesus operating as both a prophet, delivering God's message, and as a really, really sharp teacher, engaging in these deep theological and, you know, let's be honest, political discussions right there in the heart of Jewish tradition.
And he doesn't back down. He keeps proclaiming his message of the kingdom of God, no matter who tries to stop him.
And that, my friends, is Luke 20 in a nutshell. I hope this has been helpful, that we've given you some new insights into this really crucial part of the story. And now, before we wrap up completely, I want to leave you with something to think about, a question to ponder.
Always with the thought-provoking questions.
Well, you know me. So think about this. How did all these different groups, the crowds, the chief priests, the scribes, the Sadducees, how did they respond to Jesus? Mm-hmm. What can that tell us about how people react to new ideas, to challenges to their beliefs? Even today, what are the stones that we're rejecting? What are the things that we're making into cornerstones?
What are the things that we're building our lives, our societies on? That's a big question.
It is. It's something to really consider, to wrestle with. And on that note, thanks for joining us for this deep dive. We hope you found it insightful.
And if you have any other sources you'd like us to unpack, just send them our way. We'll be here ready to dive in.
Absolutely. Until next time, keep seeking, keep questioning.